This is a class at Miami University in Interactive Media Studies, and it's a course on politics, culture, and new media.
Okay.
So, and what we do is, when I live in Oxford half the time and we have kind of conventional or traditional classroom lectures and discussions, and then when I'm in D.C., we do the video conference and we talk to political players and journalists about what they do and how, with a focus on how things have changed over the past 10, 20, 30, 40 years because of new media.
Okay.
And so we had the students and I all read, we read the Weekly Standard piece, we read the New Yorker piece on you, we looked at the Stone Zone, and then we also watched the Reason TV interview that we did last year.
Mm-hmm.
And the students have generated questions to ask you. My first question is, how did the Stone Zone get started, and what are you, what's your audience and what's your goal in that?
Well, my goal is to tell people what they can't read anyplace else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I hit the Democrats and the liberals a lot, but I hit the Republicans too, because I'm kind of a hardened observer of the political scene. I've been through, this is 9 presidential campaigns. I've been to 10 national conventions, 1 Democratic. I was kind of subterranean, and the other 9 Republican.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty hard-boiled in terms of the realities of what's going on there, out there in politics, what it really means, and I'm an equal opportunity slagger. It doesn't matter. I mean, I kind of call them like I see them.
What was the Democratic convention, and what were you doing there?
I went to the 1976 National Convention in New York, mm-hmm. the Democratic convention. I went there as part of a truth squad, so
mm-hmm.
we were cranking out, you know, immediate responses to the nonsense coming from the podium.
And that was, you guys, do you know who was running in 1976? Like, what was the drama of the Democratic convention? All right. Well,
okay.
They don't, but that was, why don't you?
Well, 1976 was the year that Ronald Reagan, the former governor of California, challenged Gerald Ford for the nomination. It's the last time we've had a really competitive national mm-hmm. convention. We got to Kansas City without knowing who our nominee would be.
Mm-hmm.
It was very close and hard fought.
And was the Republican convention
was
before the
Democrats? It was after the Democrats. So the Carter convention took place.
Yeah.
And we were trying to preserve our options for a competitive general election. I believe that Reagan, being an outsider, could beat Carter. We could
mm-hmm.
steal. Carter was trying to steal our message, and
right.
we were trying to steal his. Ford was the quintessential insider, and he paid the price,
mm-hmm.
You know, by being connected to the Republican Party in the immediate aftermath of Watergate. But at the same time, it's instructive that Nixon was driven from office in 1974, and only 18 months later, we lost the presidency by a point,
mm-hmm.
Which kind of shows you the resilience of the two-party system, I think.
Yeah. Who wants to ask the first question of Roger Stone? We talked earlier today, before you came, we were talking about your public persona and the various constituent parts that go into that, but who wants to open the question session?
As George Bush would say, "Bring it on."
Okay.
You had mentioned that you would never admit, you know, in your recent interview, you had said you would never admit if you did something you were ashamed of. But what do you feel is maybe the most ruthless political move that you've ever done?
Well, if I told you that, it wouldn't be ruthless anymore. But let me make...
Well, I mean, you brought in all these articles. We've heard about a lot of your moves. I mean, it seems like it's very something that you don't, like, hide necessarily.
Well, probably notifying the FBI about Governor Spitzer's dalliances with prostitutes, which I think at least contributed to his downfall. I don't claim that I brought him down, because at the time I learned this information and informed the federal authorities, I don't know whether they already knew it. I don't know if it was just a piece of a puzzle that they had largely already
mm-hmm.
assembled, or whether it got the ball rolling. So I make no claim, but I would like to make this distinction, because I get tagged as a dirty trickster,
mm-hmm.
and now that it's written, it's written, so I'll go with it. But I think there's a distinction, a very important distinction, between political pranks that are maybe funny or amusing,
mm-hmm.
and have the purpose of harassing your opponents, I don't really believe in that. If I'm going to be involved in something hard-hitting, it has to be vote productive and legal. I think politics is not beanbag, and that and that hard-edged tactics have been used since the beginning of the Republic. But I think they have to have a purpose other than just to be, you know, irritating or amusing to us, that is.
Are New Yorkers better off, from your point of view, that Spitzer's out of office?
Oh, there's no question. First of all, David Paterson sounds like Ronald Reagan when it comes to spending and taxes. Suddenly, he's found religion. So now the state's in a budget crisis, and he has said to his own party, look, and the unions, look, the party's over. We just can't keep spending ourselves and taxing ourselves into oblivion. So they have a de facto conservative Republican governor now in many ways. I think Paterson's an honest guy. I think he's a straightforward guy. I kind of like him. He's got a sense of humor, which Elliot Spitzer certainly never had. That, I think, caused a change in the state Senate. And although I have a high regard for Senator Bruno, he chose to retire. So you've now got new leadership in the governor's office, new leadership in the state Senate. It's a shame we don't have new leadership in the state assembly, but that'll come. It'll come.
Next question. Scott, what do you want to ask? Or Nick, you have your hand up in the back, so go ahead.
Yeah, in the articles, it seems to kind of feel the Bush administrations, both of them, have done great damage to the Republican Party. And I was kind of wondering, what ways do you see that this Bush administration has done damage to the Republican Party, and why do you throw your support at John McCain, and why do you see him as someone different from that administration?
Sure. Well, first of all, I have never been a Bush Republican. I consider myself a Goldwater, Reagan, more libertarian-oriented Republican. Take your pick. I mean, the only thing I like about the Bush administration is their tax policy. I am for tax reduction because I do think it makes the economy grow. But you couldn't be a conservative and spend like this administration is spending. They're spending us, you know, into the millennium. You couldn't be a conservative and approve of the growth of government in the 8 years George Bush has been governor, been president. And then lastly, I think this war is pointless. I don't see the point of the war in Iraq. Now, if you wanted to have war against the Saudis, I'm with you.
No.
They're our problem in the region. They are not our friends. But the Bush administration kisses up to the Saudis, and yet we're at war in Iraq that, to me, doesn't seem to have any point. Now, when we need to use hardball tactics against the Iranians, we've worn out the goodwill of the American people who don't have the stomach for more conflict. He's done huge damage to the party.
How does that translate into support for McCain?
Well, I don't think John McCain is George Bush. I think that McCain has been with the Bush administration, with the exception of the war, largely when they're right. But McCain, who I've known for 20 years, is very definitely his own man. He didn't challenge George W. Bush in 2000 for no reason. I do think he has already demonstrated to a great extent that he will go his own way, that he will take on iconoclastic fights that would seem out of type for your average conservative Republican. I think it's a cheap shot to say that he's four more years of George Bush. He's not. I think he'll be very different. I really think he is a reformer. I really think he hasn't been afraid to take on the tobacco companies, the trial bar, so many other special interests that the administration certainly never taken on.
How brilliant from a political strategy point of view was the Palin pick?
Breathtaking, because it takes advantage of a discord in the Democratic Party caused essentially by the dumping of Hillary Clinton. They not only don't nominate her, even though she gets 18 million votes, but they don't seriously consider her for the ticket, leaving the Republican Party a big, fat opening. Now, a lot of people thought that all of the women who supported Hillary were ultra-liberals, and therefore they couldn't possibly be attracted by a Palin candidacy. That's turned out to be false. I think many of the women who supported Hillary supported her because they felt that it was important to elect a woman president. They thought that the role of women was expanding and that this would be history-making. We're going to get 30% of the people who voted for Hillary, I think, are going to vote for the McCain-Palin ticket. And that's very significant. I also like it because it wrenched control of the Republican Party away from the party establishment. The Republican establishment in Washington does not like John McCain. They don't like him because they can't trust him to go along and keep his mouth shut. He really is a maverick. I disagree with Matt Welch in this regard. And Sarah Palin didn't go to Yale. She's not a part of the fraternity here in town. She's truly an outsider in the sense that McCain is an outsider. So I think that she is out of the Goldwater, Reagan, Laxalt brand of Western frontier conservatism, which is not an Ivy League establishment, Eastern institutions brand of republicanism. I think she's a breath of fresh air.
Next question. Scott, what would you ask?
Well, my question kind of goes back to what you were saying earlier about your slanderous techniques or your hardball techniques. I don't understand why the New Yorker may mention that you have a beef with Karl Rove. What's that about?
Well, that goes back to a college Republican fight in the 70s where I believe that he and his friends forged a bunch of proxies. But let's go back to your question. I don't consider any of my activities slanderous, because to be slanderous, I would have to be saying or communicating or publicizing things that were not true. And I've never done that. I don't believe in that. I think these negative TV ads, like the one on sex education on Barack Obama, are actually counterproductive. Bad research. And it's cost him, because it was a juvenile stunt, in my opinion, completely unnecessary and not germane to the campaign. Now, had it been accurate and had that ad been aired in the right markets, it could have been effective or even devastating. But instead, it was a cheap shot. And this is an area I agree with Rove. My real beef with Rove is that he lost us both houses of Congress, and he drove the Republican Party to its lowest approval rating in decades. This is the architect of what? Failure? The Republican Party has bred no bench. We have no hard-charging, attractive, young conservative candidates coming up the pike. That's why our choices for vice president were so dismal. Mitt Romney, please, give me a break. The guy was a liberal 3 minutes ago. He keeps going around talking about Ronald Reagan. In 1980, he supported Paul Tsongas for president. He's not a conservative. If anything, he's a convenient conservative. So he was a liberal yesterday. He's a conservative today. What will he be tomorrow? I don't think he knows what he believes in other than getting elected.
Well, and that goes to the question about consistency that people we were discussing earlier, about why do people prize consistency over time in politicians? And part of it is one hopes it's predictive in the future, that if you say the same thing over time, you'll act that way. Next question. Jason, what's a question?
Well, you kind of define yourself as a libertarian, and you also promote the two-party system, saying it's like a really difficult thing to break into. Do you think there's any possibility in the future of the Libertarian Party actually playing a larger role than it does now as a possible third party, or is that too far of a reach?
I think play a role is the right expression. I think that the problem we have is that the laws in the 50 states, as well as the federal laws, are completely stacked against any new party. And it would require real reform of state laws and federal election laws to make a third party viable. There's no question that the Perot phenomena demonstrates that there's an interest in a third party in America. There's a hunger. But I think the role that parties like the Libertarians have is keeping the Republicans honest. It's kind of like
that,
the role...
I'm sorry, by the way, that is... in a second, but that's the vice president's motorcade that goes by here every day at the same time.
See, Cheney does it to me again.
Okay, so you were saying, though, about there's a hunger for a third party.
I think there's
an
interest in a third party, but I think the Libertarian Party is important, because it keeps pressure on the Republicans to keep them honest, and it keeps issues in the forefront that wouldn't normally be in the forefront in a presidential campaign. Will they ever elect a president? Will the two-party system in this country ever collapse or be expanded? I don't think so, not as long as the laws are currently stacked the way they are. So therefore, I think the Republican Party is the traditional home of conservatives, as Barry Goldwater said, and I think we got to fight it out within the party.
Can you, how many of you are familiar with Barry Goldwater? I mean, you've heard the name, right? But, I mean, give a capsule summary of who Barry Goldwater was and why he's so important in your mythology as well as in contemporary politics.
Barry Goldwater was a U.S. senator from Arizona. He espoused a brand of non-racist, non-anti-Semitic, optimistic conservatism, a strong and anti-communist, a strong for national defense, strong for fiscal discipline. He really is the father in many ways of the modern conservative movement. He was a reluctant candidate for president in 1964. He defeated Nelson Rockefeller for the Republican nomination. But in that act, he seized control of the Republican Party from the Eastern liberal establishment of Tom Dewey and Nelson Rockefeller and Herb Brownell and others. And we've never given it back. I mean, without Goldwater, there would have been no Reagan. Without Goldwater, there would have been no Nixon comeback. Without the Nixon comeback, there would have been no Reagan. Without Reagan, there would have been no Bush. That's the bad news. But he changed the whole face of the party. He made us the party of the Sun Belt, the party of the South and the West, no longer just the party of the Eastern Seaboard. And he also made us the conservative party, which ultimately made the Democratic Party the liberal party. So the importance is that within the United States, we had the kind of ideological realignment that they have in Britain. There used to be both liberal Republicans and conservative Republicans. There used to be both liberal Democrats and conservative Democrats. Those days are over, and that began with Goldwater. The Republican Party is the conservative party. The Democratic Party is the liberal party. And it's much clearer for voters. I think it offers the voters a clearer choice. Therefore, I think that's why he's a seminal figure.
You know, the Harris poll since the early 70s has been asking voters, American voters, what is your affiliation, not necessarily who you're registered with. In 1970 or thereabouts, 49% of Americans identified with the Democratic Party. That number is now down around 36, 37. It was about 30 or 31% for Republicans, and it's about there now. What, if the choices are clearer, why haven't we seen a huge growth in the affiliation of people with the Republican Party? And what explains the loss of market share from the Democrats?
Actually, I think it has to do, the loss of market share or the stagnation of it has to do with information overload. In 1970, there were only three national networks to get your information from, CBS, ABC, and NBC. And therefore, information was more filtered and it was more limited, and people, in essence, had fewer choices. Now with the internet, with a wider spectrum of political views available for everybody to consume, to consider, to participate in, I think voters are more independent. I think there's a less of a desire to associate with a specific party. People say, well, I vote the person. I don't vote the party. Or I vote my philosophy. I don't vote the party. I think that's a very healthy thing, actually.
Lindsay, what's a question you would like to ask?
This is unrelated to what we were talking about before, but you experiment with a lot of forms of media, from podcasts to videos and internet blogging. Which form do you find most convincing to the general public, or do you like using?
Well, I think that the internet has gotten so large and so efficient that that one cannot just post a website and hope that people find you. You have to go out proactively and find them. The Stone Zone blasts 250,000, 300,000 email addresses every week. So when I post something new, I let you know that it's there and I give you a link to go find it. I don't wait for you to be surfing and just happen to bump into me. And because of the modern technology, I can look at a panel, and every time Nick Gillespie goes online to read what I have, I can see that he's on. I can see how long he stays on. So it's a little bit like that movie Sliver. It's very voyeuristic. You can see that Carl Icahn is reading your stuff, or that somebody in the White House is reading your stuff. And so
what has been the biggest traffic generator for you? I mean, or what pieces have been
the Spitzer stuff by far got the best response. I think only because I turned out to be right. In other words, it's very interesting to me. The New York Times 3 days ago does a big piece about secrecy in the Palin administration, and they make a great deal out of the fact that Palin's aides in the governor's office use their personal emails instead of the government emails allegedly so they can conceal their government activities. Everybody around Governor Spitzer used their personal emails. Mm-hmm. The New York Times didn't seem to have any problem with that. Mm-hmm. Even when everyone else was saying, come clean, give us all the evidence about whether you were misusing the state police for political purposes, mm-hmm. there were no editorials in the New York Times complaining mm-hmm. about the fact that the governor's aides were shielding the information by using their personal email addresses. So, and the entire question of Spitzer, where from the beginning, I questioned his temperament to be governor, I questioned his judgment, I questioned his qualifications, I questioned his history of illegal activities. And a lot of people said, well, this guy's nuts.
Is there any, with somebody like Elliot, or in the Spitzer case, is there any way that a politician, an elected official, can have a sex scandal like that and survive it? Or is that just radioactive?
Well, I still think the fundamental problem was not engaging a prostitute. I think mm-hmm. the fundamental problem was engaging a prostitute when you had a history of locking up other people
right.
for being in the business. I mean, the real issue here is one of hypocrisy. So let's take former Congressman Colby from Arizona, mm-hmm. conservative Republican, who came out publicly and said that he was gay. The voters didn't hold that against right. him because there was no hypocrisy. He wasn't lying about being gay, and he mm-hmm. wasn't voting for gay bashing legislation, and he wasn't, you know, crusading against gay marriage. He mm-hmm. was very honest with the voters, and no voters held it against him.
Yeah.
Not saying that was a scandal, but it was certainly a major revelation. Mm-hmm. So I think it depends on the individual circumstances.
Mm. Chelsea, give us a question.
Totally just making this up on the spot. Have you found that the Miami community has... Do you still live in Miami, correct?
Yes.
Have you found that the Miami community or that has adopted you in a different way than D.C. did?
Well, first of all, D.C. is the phoniest place on the face of the earth. If you want to meet real people, if you want to meet genuine people, go to Hollywood over Washington, D.C., this is a town where everybody's your friend when you're up and nobody's your friend when you're down. Because my wife is Cuban, because she has a large Cuban family, and because of the Cuban community's relationship with the Republican Party, I have in many ways been embraced by the more conservative wing of the party there. I'm very proud of my activities helping Charlie Crist get elected governor. I think he's a great governor. I think he's doing a great job. And Miami is, let's face it, it's a sunny place for shady people. So, you know, the intrigue of some of the things I do kind of fits right in.
Megan, can you ask a question?
Well, I kind of have like a simple side note to that question. I have a sibling who is a student at University of Miami. I wonder if you did any work trying to get the folks, the student body there, if that was like... Anything?
I haven't specifically, but it raises an interesting question, which is given the millions of dollars that the Obama campaign is spending on voter registration, particularly among students, whether that opens the door to serious abuse where students vote twice. They vote once where their parents live or where they're from, and then they vote again where they're at college. That is, of course, a felony. And it would take very sophisticated tracking, but it was very interesting in the 2000 election that was so close. The New York Post tracked thousands of New Yorkers who voted both in New York and in Palm Beach County.
Hmm.
Thousands. So when you consider that Bush only won by a handful of votes, those illegal votes are very significant.
Is there a youth vote? Because going back to your time with Nixon, the first election that... 18-year-olds could vote in was 72, correct? And they did not turn out in big numbers, and they did not necessarily go for McGovern, right?
That's both true.
Yeah.
It remains to be seen. I think that there is some youth vote, obviously, because there's a subgroup of people mm-hmm. between 18 and 25 who are voting. But it remains to be seen whether politics can hold the attention of younger voters mm-hmm. long enough to get them to the polls.
Mm-hmm.
How many people turn out this November for Obama? Or for McCain for that purpose, is going to be very instructive in that regard. It is true that thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of students are being registered. Mm-hmm. Whether they really show up is an open question. I mean, I was thinking that if you didn't want them to show up, you could, like, release a new video game the night before the election, mm-hmm. and everybody'd stay up all night and nobody'd show up.
Well, we'll see if that happens.
Throw a beer blast in there, yeah. and you could complete the
Well,
whole
this at Miami University, there was a power outage this weekend, and so there was no classes and massive drinking. So that might be another way of doing it. Can the other Megan ask a question, please?
The other Megan? Yeah,
yes.
So we were kind of talking about this in class, and so I wanted to get your take on it. As someone who tends to bring scandal to the forefront, what do you think about the fact that people in the media seem to be focusing more on the scandalous and typical lowest points of politicians instead of the issues themselves? We talked about Colin at the focus on her daughter's pregnancy.
Well, it has to do with human nature. You know, why do we all want to see a car crash when we drive by? Politicians learned a long time ago that if you put out a 40-page white paper on your views on the environment, mm-hmm. that no one will read it, no one cares, the voters are bored by it, the media won't cover it. So when you try to be substantive and you try to be issue-oriented, the voters get very bored very quickly. Let's face it, like the song goes, we like dirty laundry. Politics is entertainment. The world of show business and politics have now intersected completely. So we're much more interested in the prurient stuff than we are in policy and policy wonkery. Consequently, unfortunately, therefore the focus is on Governor Palin's daughter or Senator Biden's son who's taken $100,000 from a credit card company's father is introducing legislation for. Those things are more interesting to people. And politics is about being interesting. When you cease to be interesting as a candidate, the voters look elsewhere. That's why riding out a lead, trying to say nothing to hold a lead, is the worst place to be in politics. I would much rather be behind than ahead. Being the front runner is the hardest place to sustain. I like where McCain is right now. I'd much rather be there than a couple points ahead. I think that he is now beginning to peak as we go into the final month, and that's about right.
Well, do you think any of the Palin scandals, Bristol Palin or this Troopergate stuff, is that going to stick? And will any of the Obama, I mean, it's not really scandals, but the Jeremiah Wright, the various non-policy related attacks on him, do those work?
Ironically, because the national media is so lathered up, and because their attacks on Palin have been so vicious and so rabid, I actually think that those things will not stick. I think that they create a sympathy for her, and secondarily, I think a lot of voters write them off as, just another liberal-oriented attack on her. Now, that assumes that we don't learn any new cataclysmic facts that we don't know today, but I don't think we're going to. I think she's the real deal. I think she really is what she appears to be. I think she is an outsider. I think she is pretty feisty. I don't think that she is the mother of the real secret mother of her daughter's baby. I think that the Daily Costs really damaged their credibility by putting that out the Monday before the Republican National Convention. So I actually think attacks on her inure to our benefit at this point.
What about Obama?
Well, I think it's a slightly different situation only because he has been so unscathed so far, despite the very best efforts of the Clinton, and because he's running for the top job, and he's still largely an unknown commodity. The best line of the convention was, what do you say about a guy that's written two, who's authored two memoirs, but no significant pieces of legislation? To me, he's a cipher. He can't point to a special interest he's ever taken on, because he's never taken one on. He can't point to any significant legislation that he pushed against great odds in either the U.S. Senate or the state Senate, because he didn't do any. I really think that when the Democrats raise the question of Palin's qualifications to be president and her experience, they're really harming Barack Obama more than they're harming her, because it elevates experience as an issue that people will begin to focus on.
You're a master. One of the things that we talked a fair amount about was creating a persona. You have a public persona. And I want to get to that in a second and talk about how various pieces fit together. But with Barack Obama and John McCain, these are like two kind of epic characters in America, in American political history, in the sense of they represent more than themselves. Who wins? Like, which persona wins? Or what's the advice that you would give to Barack Obama and to John McCain, as these two guys are going to be clashing in presidential debates and whatnot?
Well, but McCain's been a national figure for 20 years, and he's had a majority of the American public know who he is for at least 8 years, perhaps 10. Whereas Barack Obama is still largely unknown to people. They like what they have seen. I think that Obama's in a very difficult position because he is articulate, he's eloquent, but there's no beef. And it's too late to create a record because he does not have one. Therefore, he is going to have to run on inspiration and hope, largely because there's nothing else to run on. On the other hand, given the sorry state of the economy and an unpopular war, it's not the worst thing to run on. In McCain's case, my advice would be just be yourself. I think through a lot of the nomination process, because of the realities of nomination politics, he hasn't been able to be himself. He's had to bite his tongue. He's had to be a little bit more of a lockstep Republican than I think he really is. Starting with the night of the convention, when he reminded people of his fights against big tobacco and the trial bar and Indian lobbyists and so on, he started to be the old McCain again. I think in these debates you're going to see the old McCain, which is the McCain people like. It's McCain the reformer. It's McCain the ballbuster. It's McCain the fighter. That's what they like.
How many of you are planning on watching the presidential debates? Okay. And all of you are planning on voting, right? Which, as I said earlier, I don't necessarily think that's a good thing, but, you know, if you want to, you should. One of the students raised the question of your Catholicism as a fact. One of the ways that we went into talking about your public presentation of yourself through journalists, speaking through journalists, through your blog, through video, etc. You know, you let certain things, aspects of your personality be known, or you control when they get out there. How does the Catholic, I mean, you know, it's mentioned in every story about you. How does your Catholicism fit into your larger image that you're trying to project?
I just think that because I'm a Catholic, because I was raised as a Catholic, because I come from a large family of Catholics, practicing Catholics, I have some understanding of Catholic values and Catholic voters, which goes beyond just religion, has a lot to do with the socioeconomic standing of Catholics, particularly in the northeastern United States where I grew up. Just because I understand working class people doesn't mean that I have to dress like them. Mm-hmm. That's the good news.
Well, that was the other part, is where does the haberdashery come in?
I don't know. It's just something, you know, since the time that I was very young, I insisted on all natural fibers. If something wasn't all cotton or all wool, I wouldn't wear it. And, it's a distinctive style. I enjoy it. Look good, feel good. Mm-hmm. If you feel like you look good, then you'll feel good. It's just it's part of my makeup. The idea of going out poorly dressed is just not something I would do.
Yeah. Well, we disagree on that for sure. So,
but if you stick with basic black, you can't go wrong.
What's the essence of the Catholic voter, the Catholic mentality in politics? Is it feeling like an outsider and striving upward, or what's the hook of that?
I still think it has more to do with basic middle-class values of thrift, of respect, of a feeling that these are the people who pay taxes, who go to work, who go to school. They don't protest. They don't demonstrate. They're really what Nixon called the forgotten Americans. Mm-hmm. I really think that they are, by and large, in our politics, they are Catholics, and we know that when Catholics vote Democratic, the Democrats win. And when Catholics vote Republican, the Republicans win. That has been the most switchable vote in the country. We know white Southerners vote Republican. We know African Americans vote Democratic. I mean, those are pretty constants. You may make some inroads from time to time, but it's Catholics in states like Pennsylvania, Michigan, Ohio. When they swing Democratic,
so
they win.
What happens with the Hispanic vote, which is largely Catholic and seems to be pretty much up for grabs?
I think it is up for grabs. I mean, the problem is that once we become depicted as an anti-immigrant party, we begin losing Hispanic votes. But Hispanic voters are strong believers in hard work. They're strong believers in the work ethic. They're patriotic. They love uniforms. They respect the military. I think that it is a vote that McCain must make inroads into in Colorado and New Mexico, at least in order to win this election. And that will, and that's actually, in my opinion, the key. In other words, I think in the final analysis, you should not look at the national polls that show this tide or McCain up 3 points or Barack Obama up 3 points. I think that's largely meaningless. As you study the election, look at Ohio, Missouri, Colorado, New Mexico, and Virginia, and probably Florida. And look at the polls in those states. Those are the states that will determine this election. Everything else is predictable, by and large. You know the Democrats will carry California and, say, Massachusetts. At this point, I think the Republicans will carry Texas and Mississippi. You know all that. Every other state is reliably predictable. Those states I just mentioned are up for grabs. And in order to win Colorado and New Mexico, I think McCain needs to fall back on his original position on immigration. He's not an immigrant basher. He has been in favor to a path to citizenship. And I think that could be very palatable to people in those states.
Who hasn't asked a question yet? Okay. Andrea, please lay it on us.
You talk about different rules you have for, I believe it's war, politics, food, fashion, and living. And a lot of the ones that they focus on with politics are kind of looking at what politicians need to do. What would you say as citizens are something like your most important rule for us?
Most important rule, read the newspaper every day. I continue to be amazed by people who don't read the newspaper. Doesn't matter whether you read it online or whether you read it in paper form. I don't see how you can be an informed citizen. I don't see how you can form opinions if you don't know what's going on in the world. I have colleagues who don't read the newspaper every day, and it just astounds me. I read 4 or 5 newspapers a day. Florida papers, national papers, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, the New York Times. I don't believe a lot of what I read, but I do think it kind of tells you where everybody's coming from. The New York Times, if you go on the Stone Zone today, I have a long piece about the vitriolic nature of the New York Times, which just seems to be leading the charge in the anti-Palin efforts. A lot of reporters that I respect, a lot of reporters that I like, a lot of reporters that I like to read have now suddenly become vitriolic about Palin. Richard Cohen in the Daily News yesterday, which I think is a Washington Post column, raising questions about Sarah Palin's qualifications to be president, or whether she has the experience to be president. No mention of Barack Obama being a cipher in there. So I would urge you to consume as much information as you can, and I can't imagine not reading the newspaper first thing in the morning.
Can you talk a little bit about how the Weekly Standard and then the New Yorker pieces happened?
Well, let's see. One of the things that I was involved in was the destruction of the Reform Party. I feel the Reform Party elected Bill Clinton not once but twice. I read that Barack Obama is meeting with Bill Clinton in New York last week, in Harlem last week, to seek his political advice. And my question is why? He never got 51% in any election, and he did far more damage to his wife's campaign than he did good. I think he's got a tin ear. I think that he assumed the presidency through luck rather than skill. No Perot, no Clinton.
This is in 1992, Clinton won the presidency with 43% of the vote, I think, which was a very low figure. It was a strong three-way race. And then against Bob Dole 4 years later, he got 49% of the vote, which is, I mean, it was interesting that we had presidents who did not win a simple majority for a number of elections there. Because George Bush also did not.
Right.
So, but how did, how did the Weekly Standard happen and then the New Yorker?
At the Reform Party convention where I was promoting the candidacy of Donald Trump, largely as kind of a holding action and then ultimately played some role in kind of coaxing Pat Buchanan into the party, which was the beginning of the end because he was more interested in the federal matching funds, I think, than in actually getting elected. And once the party drops below a certain level of votes, they're no longer eligible for federal matching funds. Buchanan got them there, and the party has disappeared. But at that convention, there was a real pain in the ass reporter named Matt Labash, mm-hmm. who was trying to figure out what we were doing, and he was very aggressive. And he was very critical of Trump, who I was working for. And we became adversaries of a type. Mm-hmm. And he wrote a very tough piece called Chump on the Stump mm-hmm. On Trump, which I had huge objections to, although Trump hated it more than I did. But then when we got back to Washington, we kept in touch. I would hear from him from time to time. And then he called me and pitched me on the story mm-hmm. and said, look, I'm going to write this story whether you cooperate or not, but I think it'd be better if you cooperated. And I thought about it, and I had a lot of misgivings because I'm a secretive kind of guy sometimes. Mm-hmm. But he wrote the story, and that, I think, led to the New Yorker
right.
story, and I guess the rest is history.
How do you, you know, the Weekly Standard piece is certainly, I mean, Matt is a tremendous journalist, and it's a really well-told tale. And it's critical, but also, I mean, everybody here, whether they're critical of you or not, I mean, they're engaged by your persona, but that must be a really difficult moment when you know the New Yorker or somebody like Labash is doing a story on you. How do you deal with that?
Well, there's obviously certain things that I don't want them to touch on, but they mm-hmm. tend to be in regard to my family life. Mm-hmm. I mean, just because I'm out there doesn't mean that when my wife or my mm-hmm. children or my other relatives are out there. I see what Barack Obama means when he tries to shield his children mm-hmm. from publicity. They didn't choose the political life, and therefore I don't think they should get beat up with me. But beyond that, you know, my favorite line was he said that I'm honest in my dishonesty. Mm-hmm. I tell you exactly what I think. I don't do the party thing. It's probably hurt me in Washington. It certainly hurt me in some party circles. I'm sorry, I won't tell you the Bushes are smart and that they were both great presidents, because mm-hmm. I don't think they were. I don't think they are conservatives. I don't think they believe in anything other than perhaps crony capitalism. And that's, you know, that's more harmful than it is helpful to someone who wants to be in the party mm. world as a partisan. Mm. But I don't know how to do it any other way. I tell you what I really think.
What, as a final kind of comment, can you talk a little bit about the role of new forms of media and information overload and whatnot? Is it good for the political process? Is it bad, or it doesn't matter, and it's just the background of how you operate now?
No, it matters tremendously mm-hmm. because it's democratized the process with a small d. And it gives everybody a seat at the table. As I said earlier, in the 70s, in the 60s, in the 50s, if something didn't appear in the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or the Washington Post, then you had no recourse. There was no way to get out different ideas, offbeat ideas, alternative ideas. If you couldn't sell your ideas to the mainstream media in some way, if the mainstream media didn't declare you viable or mm-hmm. sane, or your ideas viable and sane, then you had no recourse. The Goldwater defeat has a lot to do with that. The media in this country decided to depict Barry Goldwater as a trigger-happy, mentally unstable warmonger,
right.
which was completely unfair. But there was no recourse.
But it was effective.
It was extremely
yeah.
effective. It destroyed yeah. him. He got 27 million votes, but he lost, you know, I think, overwhelmingly. He lost.
Yeah.
It was a crushing defeat for the party. So much so that a lot of people question whether the party could ever come back. Maybe it was over for the Republican Party. Today, everyone here, everyone around that table, has a seat at the table. If you don't like what's going on, if your ideas are more provocative or more interesting, if you don't like what you read in the New York Times or the Cleveland Plain Dealer, then you can go online and combat it. You can post an alternative. You can sell an alternative. You can promote an alternative. So I think it's been great for the process. It's why I started the Stone Zone. It's why I was so delighted to do the Reason TV mm-hmm. thing, which I got great response to. CBS wouldn't come and do that.
Yeah.
It's too outside the box for them. They're not interested in things that are outside mm-hmm. the box. They're only interested in things that are establishment-oriented. So I think it has opened our politics wide open. It sparks more thought. It sparks more participation. I think it's the greatest thing since mm-hmm. sliced bread.